Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org, check out all the things that are going on over there under the tab podcast. You know, the year is coming to an end. And that means two things are going on. As the year draws to an end, it also means that, you know, this would be a good time for you to support 1517, Christ Old Fast, 40 minutes, the whole thing. Be a good time to do it. If you got a year-end gift, it is tax-deductible, and you could become a supporter. Or you could just do a one-time dump. You could do that, too. You could do that over at 1517.org or Christ Old Fast. People like you making everything possible while helping us get the gospel out to as many people as possible in as many ways as possible. The other thing, though, that is happening as the year comes to an end is that January 1, the remaining Here We Still Stand tickets, which is not many, the price does go up January 1. So maybe you need to be buying that as a Christmas present to yourself. Maybe you need to be buying that for a Christmas present for you and someone else. But you want to do it now because you don't want the price increase. You want that early Chad Bird special. And it's only here till January 1. So get on it. Get on it. You want to get it. And plus, we're like 75% sold out. So if the price is not motivation enough, because maybe you just have so much money, you're like, oh, I don't bother myself with things like price increases. Well, you should bother yourself with things like all the tickets being sold out. So get on it, because we want to hang out with you. We're going to be talking about the Apostles' Creed. You know, Chad, that Apostles' Creed's been in the news lately. It's been an interesting thing, you know. We had the funeral of George H.W. Bush.
Oh, yes. The Creed was front and center.
It was. I have not seen the Creed get so much publicity, which, here's the thing, it was fairly discouraging. I mean, so our current president did not recite the Creed. I think that's kind of here nor there. I don't know that that matters one way or the other. If you asked me, do you suspect that he knows the Apostles' Creed, I would have said no. What is shocking is certain responses to it. So there's actual pastors out there, Protestant pastors, that say, I wouldn't recite that creed either. It's Catholic. Now, it's one thing when, you know, someone who's, you know, devotion to the church is, we'll say, ambiguous. It's another thing when people in the church that are preaching are saying things like, I'm good on you. I wouldn't recite that creed either. I'm like, whoa, dude. Like, the Apostles' Creed is a, like, Catholic little c, bud. And so it just reinforced that it's something that maybe we need to talk about a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been around for almost all of the church's life, so it is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I saw was a pastor actually say, as a born-again Christian, I wouldn't recite it. And I was like, I would say that if you cannot recite it, you may not be a Christian, man. Like, the point of the Apostles' Creed is to say, like, hey, can you agree with these things? That means you're a Christian. If you can't, you're kind of not. Like, yeah. This is the bare minimum. It's the lowest hurdle.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the condensation. This is the summary of the faith that the church has recited. Well, yeah, every since almost the beginning. I mean, you had the rule of faith, as it was called, and the second century church fathers already talk about that, and that's what became the Apostles' Creed. So this is not an innovation that came about in the Middle Ages. It's nothing that the Reformation came up with. It's something that has been on the church's lips, just almost since the beginning. So you're right. I mean, this is the bare bones. If you can't confess the creed, if you can't confess this, like, summary of what the Christian faith is all about, then there's some bigger issues there.
Well, it's actually developed to figure out if you're a Christian or not. Like, that's the point of it.
It's kind of the purpose of it. Yeah.
There's no non-heretics that can't confirm it. The reason we designed the conference this year around it is because it is a unifying force. I mean, the name of the conference this year is Here We Still Stand, but the theme is the common faith. This is the most, this is like the common faith we hold, right? I mean, this is Lutherans and Catholics and Presbyterians and Anglicans and non-denominational, everybody can agree with this. And I was mistaken. So anyway, you should come out. That's all a big aside. You should come out and explore that with us. Chad, enough about that. We are still trudging through the desert in the Book of Numbers.
Yeah, we're still in the desert. We're getting closer, but we're not there to the promised land yet. Well, we've been there, but we had to turn back. Yeah, we finished up chapter 17 last time, and I think I've slept a few times since then, but I think that we talked a little bit about chapter 18. I'm gonna quickly summarize what 18 is all about, and then we're gonna jump into chapter 19, which is extremely interesting. It's the section where Moses talks about one of the strangest sacrifices of the Old Testament. It's the only sacrifice where the victim has to be a certain color, and the ashes of that victim are used in a very specific way. So we will be there momentarily. So chapter 17 of Numbers, 16 and 17, if you recall, 16 was all about the Korah rebellion. And then 17 was where God made it abundantly clear that he had chosen the tribe of Levi, and then specifically the family of Aaron, to serve him and to serve in his tabernacle. And that was brought about by, if you remember, every leader had a staff or a rod that was placed inside the holy place. And in the morning, when these were brought out, only the staff of Aaron had sprouted and put forth these blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. And so that was God's way of making it very clear, without a doubt, that Aaron's tribe was a tribe that he had chosen. So this follows on the heels of the whole controversy around the Levites and Korah and the other rebels who were giving Moses and Aaron all kinds of trouble. So chapter 18 logically follows from that whole controversy, because it's in chapter 18 that we have delineated once more the various responsibilities of the Levites and the priest. So you have the tribe of Levi. So when we talk about the Levites, we could mean one of two things. We could just be simply talking about those who belong to the Levitical tribe. So all male and female descendants of Levi are Levites. But usually when the scriptures talk about the Levites, they're talking about the male Levites who are the assistants to the priest in the tabernacle and then later in the temple. So these Levites are not priests, but they are of the tribe of Levi, but they're not of the family of Aaron. So each tribe had different families, and all those who were not of the family of Aaron, but who were in the tribe of Levi of a certain age would serve as helpers, assistants, workers at the tabernacle. And what chapter 18 does is basically break down what we've talked about this before in Leviticus as well as in Exodus, the various duties of the Levites. Remember, the Levites would carry things from location to location when they broke up the camp and they had to take down the tabernacle. The Levites were the ones who were in charge of carrying the sacred utensils of the tabernacle. They also did various other kinds of service around the tent of meeting. And then later in Israel's history, when the temple was built under Solomon, and it expanded in importance and significance and became really kind of the economic heart of the nation of Israel, you had even more going on. You can imagine how many duties the priests and Levites had when you had literally millions of people streaming into Jerusalem for the festival of Passover and the other festivals. So they needed a lot of manpower to make sure that everything got done that needed to be done.
You know, Chad, what this reminds me of is there's two times a year where I see pastors get a little complainy on social media.
Only two times?
Yeah, only two times. But specifically two times. Advent and during Holy Week, so leading up to Easter. And it's because there's additional services and whatnot. There's all these things going on, and they're like, oh, man, gotta preach three sermons this week. You know, this sort of thing. Talk about how busy they are. I've never liked that. You've served as a pastor. I've served as a pastor. I read about like what the original pastors, the original guys did, and I'm like, these Levites, man, they're working. I mean, these guys are hauling stuff, carrying stuff, tearing stuff down, setting stuff up, just slaughtering things all day long. You know, I mean, you want to talk about a full-time gig. I mean, these guys have got a lot of duties to perform. If you were like,
lot of physical labor.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I mean, this is back-breaking, exhausting work. So, it kind of puts things into perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're a little spoiled.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, so what Chapter 18 does is break down some of those duties. And it also describes kind of something interesting, because it says that one of the, it's not necessarily like an actual duty, but it's more like a purpose. So the purpose of the priest and the purpose of the Levites is, in the language of chapter 18, to bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and to bear the guilt in connection with the priesthood. And what that means is that the priest and the Levites, one of their purposes was basically to be a shield between the sanctuary and the people. So if a non-Levite or a non-Aaron person, just what we today would call a layman, decided that he was going to walk into the tabernacle forecourt and bring his lamb and slaughter it and start putting its blood on the altar and offering it as a sacrifice, and then taking some blood and walking into the holy place and maybe even into the Holy of Holies, that would not have been good. In fact, we have a couple of occasions where things similar to that happened, and the outcome was often deadly. If not deadly, at least the person who did it was struck by leprosy on the site. So one of the responsibilities, one of the purposes of the Levites and the priest, the Aaronic priest, was to be a shield, to actually, literally, they were guards of the sanctuary to make sure that the only people who were doing what God had given Israel to do were either the Levites or the priests themselves. So in that way, they bore the guilt. They bore the responsibility for making sure that God's worship happened in the way that God had decreed it to happen. So that's also what this particular chapter talks about. But most of the material in here we've covered before in Exodus and Leviticus, so that's about all that I'm going to say about that chapter. I think if you read through it yourself, you'll hear a lot of familiar language from our earlier studies. So that's chapter 18. And I think with that, we'll just jump right into chapter 19, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is a pretty fascinating chapter. So chapter 19, in its entirety, actually, is about a sacrifice that was very unique, because this is the only sacrifice in which not only the animal was specified, and not only the sex of the animal was specified, but even the color of the animal was specified. So we have a lot of sacrifices in those first few chapters of Leviticus where it can be a male, or it can be a male or a female, or sometimes it has to be a female. Sometimes it can be a lamb or a goat or an ox or even a turtle dove. But this particular sacrifice has to be a heifer, and it has to be an unblemished heifer. And not only does it have to be unblemished and a heifer, but it also has to be the color red. So that is what makes this particular sacrifice unique. Now, this unblemished red heifer, the color is significant, I think, and I've checked out the commentators, and they largely agree with this, because it's as if, okay, every sacrifice, every animal sacrifice is a bloody sacrifice, right? I mean, that's part of what happens. And the blood, of course, is very significant. But it's as if the color of this particular heifer is chosen in order to make the sacrifice even bloodier, I guess would be the way to put it. Not only are you going to have the blood of the sacrifice, but even the animal herself, even her, the color of her hide is indicative of the central aspect of the sacrifice, and that is the shedding of blood. So you have this extra bloody sacrifice, if you will, denoted by the color of the heifer. But there's other weird things about this sacrifice as well. Of course, most of the sacrifices, in fact, almost all of them, took place in front of the altar there in the forecourt of the tabernacle, but not this one. In this particular case, this unblemished red heifer is taken outside the camp, and it's outside the camp where the animal is slaughtered in front of the priest. In this particular case, it's Aaron's son Eleazar, who is the named priest. So this unblemished red heifer taken outside the camp, it's slaughtered in the presence of Eleazar the priest. And then he does kind of a strange thing. He takes some of the blood of the sacrifice and facing the front of the tabernacle, he sprinkles that blood kind of in the direction of the tabernacle seven times. So it's kind of like the blood, even though he's far away, he's way outside the camp, it's like the blood is aimed at the mercy seat. It's sprinkled in that particular direction. Then after that happens, the animal in its entirety is burned. So it's hide, its flesh, its blood. I mean, everything, there's nothing left over. Everything is burned. And not only that, so this keeps getting stranger. Not only that, but while the animal is being burned, there's some ingredients that are also added to the fire. And these are three. You've got cedar wood, and you've got hyssop, which was I guess you could call it like a spongy plant. It was used for almost like a paintbrush to dip into something. That's what hyssop was used, for instance, to dab the blood of the Passover lamb onto the lintel and the doorpost of the Israelite homes during the 10th plague. And then you add so cedar wood and hyssop and what's called scarlet material. Scarlet material was made from the particular worm that was crushed up and used to make this scarlet. Used to put the color scarlet into various kinds of cloth. So you've got the sacrifice outside the camp. You have the fire, and you have all this stuff that is added to the fire while it's being burned. And then once everything is burned up, you take all of these ashes, and they keep them in this special place outside the camp. And what happens, why was all this done? Well, it was done not to atone for like a particular sin that someone committed, but instead this was all done in order to cleanse anyone who came into contact with death. So if a person had a family member who died and the corpse had to be cared for, or even if they were like inside a tent in which there was a dead body, you know, everybody wakes up in the morning and maybe, you know, grandma has passed away during the night. And so they are, by virtue of their enclosed vicinity to a corpse, they are rendered ritually unclean. So anytime you have contact with a corpse, we've talked about this before, then you are deemed ritually unclean. So what has to happen is that you enter into a 7-day period of uncleanness, meaning you can't go to the tabernacle, you can't offer sacrifices, you can't join with the rest of Israel in the worship of God there at the holy place. So the ashes of the red heifer and everything that was burned with that red heifer are kept in this clean place. And then if a person becomes ritually unclean, some of those ashes are mixed with water and placed upon the unclean person on day 3 of their uncleanness and then day 7 of their uncleanness. And it was, as a result of this ashy water from the sacrifice mixed with water sprinkled on the person on day 3 and on day 7, afterward, they're clean. Their contact with death has been cleansed, purified, and they're once more able to enter into the worship of God at the tabernacle, and they are no longer in this state of ritual uncleanness. So that's the purpose of this particular sacrifice. That's what sets it apart from all the other sacrifices. And I think the reason that the color of the heifer is significant is because the situation itself is so significant. You know, we tend to think in terms of guilt being the main issue. You know, so we've done something wrong, or we haven't done what we should have done, and so we feel guilty, and so we desire forgiveness. We want to be cleansed of our guilt. But for most of the Old Testament, and I think you could say the New Testament as well, the primary problem that humanity faces is not sin in the sense of wrongdoing, but the primary problem we face is death. And so God is not concerned merely with forgiving us, taking away our guilt, but he's mainly concerned with taking away our death and the stain, the uncleanness that we have from death itself. And this is God's ritual detergent, as it's often called in the Old Testament, to cleanse his people of their contact with death, and then to make them ready and fit to enter into his presence again.
Yeah, I mean, death is most certainly, it's the main part of the curse. I mean, the original promise is, you know, the day you eat of the fruit, you shall surely die, right? This is the main thing. Everything else that is part of the fall is just leading up to the ultimate ramification, which is death. And Paul especially talks about it this way, that death is this enemy. Death is at enmity with God. God is not a fan of death. I mean, we see in the life of Jesus, when he comes in contact with death, he's at war with it. He comes to defeat death by dying, but that is the enemy. That is, I mean, so, I mean, you have sin, death, and the devil. That's a, sort of the unholy trinity, right? Of things that God has come to make war against, sin, death, and the devil. And death is a huge deal, and something that I don't think it's a stretch to say that God hates it. God hates death. Yeah, he did not create life so that it would die.
Yeah, it's not like our bodies were created with an expiration date, right?
Right.
Yeah. Thus far shall you live and no further. And so death is never natural, even though we speak that way in kind of everyday discussions about, you know, somebody passed away, somebody died, and we say, well, what happened? And they say, oh, it was just old age, or just, you know, this died a natural death, as opposed to like a car wreck or cancer or something like that. And I know we all know what we mean by that, but at the same time, we ought to know that we're wrong, because to speak of death as natural is to speak of death as if it's built into nature itself. It's not. It's an enemy that's infiltrated nature, and death is in fact the most unnatural thing to ever happen to a person.
Yeah, I mean, all the time we'll be, you know, you might hear like, well, circle of life, Chad.
Yeah,
and right. I'm like, no, circle of the fall.
Yeah,
circle of the consequences of sin, but it sure
yeah, that's the only circle there is.
Yeah, it's not circle of life though.
No. So death is an enemy that has invaded creation, and therefore should never, ever be treated as if it's just God's way of taking care of us and taking us out of this world. Well, no, death is the enemy that Christ has defeated and will be defeated finally and fully in the resurrection of the body on the last day.
But I mean, this is what's interesting. You know, in Revelation, like, it speaks about death in ways that you just aren't natural to speak about death. I mean, think about throwing death into the pit. So this is what Revelation says, that death and Hades, so death and the grave, are cast into hell. That hell, what hell is really about, is the destruction of the grave, about the destruction of death itself, the destruction of the devil. That's why it's a thing.
Yeah, it's you know, it's personified. Maybe we should talk more about the Grim Reaper. But you know, we don't really talk that way anymore. But the Grim Reaper is death personified.
Yeah.
And that's when you cast death into the lake of fire, that's a personification of death, and the slaying of death is what we all wait for.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to think about talking about death in terms of that you could take it and then cast it. Like you're talking about you're talking about death as a person, as an entity in that point. I'm going to take this and I'm going to throw it over there. That's a weird way to talk about death, because death for us is just something that happens. But to God, it's not like that at all.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we've kind of done the same thing with death that we have with evil. We kind of make evil something abstract. But, well, for instance, at the end of the Lord's Prayer, I think a more literal way to render the deliver us from evil at the Lord's Prayer is actually deliver us from the evil one. So deliver us not just from evil as some sort of abstract thing out there, but rather deliver us from the evil one. So Satan is a personification of evil, and just like death is personified. So I think that helps to make evil and death more tangible, more concrete. It's not just something kind of floating out there in the abstract, but it's something that is real, like an enemy that's stalking you.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to say deliver us from, you know, deliver us from Chad Bird, you would know that you were talking about an individual.
Something specific, yeah.
Well, if your name wasn't Chad and your name was Evil, and we said deliver us from evil, you would know that we were talking about someone, right? And so when we say deliver us from evil, we're not just talking about some force or some thing that happens. It's the name of someone that we need to be delivered from.
Yeah. And that's why, for instance, in the Psalms, if you pray through the Psalms, evil is usually not talked about in any sort of abstract way. It's actually named evil people who are doing evil things. And so that's kind of in line with this personification of evil.
Yeah. Or they'll use the phrase the wicked. Mm-hmm. Well, we think about wickedness the same way. Wickedness is sort of, you know, that's not a person, but when the Psalms does it, it talks about the fate of the wicked or the plans of the wicked, right? That's just another way of saying of the evil.
Yeah, yeah. What's kind of strange about getting back to the sacrifice? What's kind of strange about it is the way that God deals with death. Yesterday, when I was my wife was getting ready, and I was talking to her about what we were going to discuss in the podcast, and I was describing the sacrifice of the red heifer, and she said, "You know, that's kind of a strange way, isn't it, to deal with death? You know, by using the ashes of something that's dead." And I told her, actually, you've hit on the great irony. I mean, that's kind of the core message that's behind this. So how does God deal with death? By death. That's the way he deals with it. So he takes an animal, a red heifer, unblemished red heifer, and he sacrifices this heifer, adds this other stuff to it. And then from those ashes of death, he adds water, sprinkles that ashen water on people, and in that way, by like putting death on those defiled by death, they are cleansed. And it's it's one of these Old Testament sacrifices that is just pregnant with gospel. I mean, the ashes of the red heifer preach beforehand the gospel of Christ. Because this is exactly the same way that God continues to deal with our defilement by death. So he, in the ultimate way, because how is death defeated? Well, death is defeated by a death. Christ buries death in his own tomb. So by the death of Christ, death itself is defeated. And then, well, how does he apply that victory over death to us? Well, he takes himself, the sacrifice, and he mixes that with water, and then he applies that to us. And in that way, we are rescued from death. So he puts himself into the water of baptism, he, the sacrifice, he, the fulfillment of the prophetic red heifer. He puts himself into the water of baptism, and that is sprinkled on us. And it's not just that we are cleansed from some sort of outward defilement, but we are cleansed from death itself. We are rescued from the bondage to sin and the bondage to death, and we're transferred into the kingdom of liberty and of life. And this is what is actually made quite explicit in the book of in the book of Hebrews. So one of the central chapters in the book of Hebrews is chapter 9. And in that particular chapter, a lot of sacrificial language is used, where he's talking about the contrast between the old covenant and the new covenant. But listen to this. See if I can find it here. Yeah. I'll start reading here at verse 11 of chapter 9 of Hebrews. He says, "When Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption." Now here's the two key verses coming up. "For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Now notice what he does there. He's, of course, contrasting the high priest entrance into the earthly tabernacle with Christ, the high priest entrance into the heavenly tabernacle. And he's saying that a high priest enters with the blood of goats and bulls, but Christ enters with his own blood. And then he makes this comparison from a lesser to a greater. He says, listen, if animal blood and the ashes of a heifer, if that could cleanse outward defiled flesh, then how much more will the blood of the Son of God, the blood of the high priest himself, who is the sacrifice and who offered himself through the eternal Spirit without blemish to God, how much more will that cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? So this animal blood and the ashes of a heifer, it doesn't get inside you. It might cleanse you ritually on the outside, but it can't get inside you. But the blood of Christ does. The blood of Christ gets all the way inside you, and it cleanses you right down to your conscience itself. It cleanses you of dead works, of the works of death, the works that lead to nothing more than the grave, in order that you might be made alive in Christ and thus be able to serve and to worship God himself, who is the living God. You can see how the author of Hebrews is using Numbers 19 and the sacrifice of the red heifer as a foreshadowing, a gospel foreshadowing of the greater sacrifice that is to come, that will work a greater and more everlasting and inward transformation, because it puts the blood of Christ and the ashes of his sacrifice into our very conscience to cleanse us there.
Yeah, I mean, as you talk about the way that you defeat death is through death, Paul says that everyone who is baptized into Christ is baptized into his death. And so in this crazy way, the way that you defeat death is to be crucified with Christ, that you die with him. That's how you obtain life, through his death. And that death is applied to you via, Paul says explicitly, if you're baptized into Christ, you are baptized into his dying. And in his dying is where death is destroyed. And if you have shared in his dying, Paul continues, then you will surely share in his living, in his rising, in his resurrection. Christ defeats death by dying and rising. We are baptized into that same death. His death is our death. And if we've been given his death, we're also given the guarantee of his resurrection. And as you talk about the blood getting all the way inside of you, well, this is exactly the sort of thing that Jesus says when he says, hey, eat my body, drink my blood, and you will live forever. You'll have eternal life. I'll raise you up on the last day. I'll cleanse you all the way down, and the grave won't hold you. It's pretty great. So it all ends up being sacramental. And being sacramental, the ties that what we have now in baptism and the Lord's Supper are all tied to the Old Testament sacrificial system, that God has not divorced his himself from means. So we had sacrifices pointing forward to the person and work of Christ, and then the person and work of Christ is applied to us via the institution of new sacraments, which would be baptism and the Lord's Supper. And he says, here's how I'm going to wash you, unite you to my death, unite you to my resurrection, and here's how I'm going to get myself into you. I'm going to do it in these ways. It's not just floating out there somewhere, and we don't know how this happens. You know, like, oh, it just happens. No, that's not how he works. He uses these tangible things. The connection points are all over the place, and the author of Hebrews makes them, and Paul makes them over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's so crucial that we're encouraging people to do what we're doing, and that is to read the Bible in its entirety, and to read it both from through the Old Testament to the New, and through the New Testament back to the Old, because all the scriptures are hyperlinked. They're all joined one to another. And you can't really understand the New Testament without the Old, and you can't really understand the fullness of the Old Testament without the New. So they have to be read in tandem. And what you were saying, I mean, is a great illustration of what you could call the continuity of God's ways of dealing with his people throughout the ages, as well as the escalation, if you will. So there's a continuity in that God always works through physical means because we're physical creatures. But when you get to Christ, there's an escalation too, where you go from the lesser to the greater, from the imperfect to the perfect, which is really what the book of Hebrews is all about. And just kind of wrap up this discussion. I want to point us to one more text that is building off Numbers 19, and that's Zechariah, the end of Zechariah 12 and the beginning of Zechariah 13. So Zechariah 12 verse 10 ends by saying that in the days of the Messiah, God is going to pour out his spirit upon the people of Jerusalem. And it says that they will look on me, whom they have pierced. Now, you know, that's quoted two different times in the New Testament, in the book of John, and then in, I think it's chapter 1 of Revelation, Zechariah is quoted there in reference to the pierced one is the Messiah. And then Zechariah goes on to say that with the result of this death, there'll be great mourning. Mourning is for a firstborn son. So this is Israel mourning for the firstborn son, the Messiah, the one whom they have seen pierced, the one that they've looked upon. And then this leads right into chapter 13, verse 1, where it says, in that day, so the day of the Messiah, the day when he is pierced, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for impurity. So this word for impurity, which is nidah in the Hebrew, same word that's used in reference to the defilement that people get as a result of death, that's going to be taken care of when a fountain opens in Jerusalem, when the people look upon the one they've pierced, this one that they mourn for like a firstborn son. And I think what Zechariah is doing, he's building off of Numbers 19. And this fountain that opens up is Christ himself. As he becomes the one who's pierced, out of his side flows blood and water. And this blood and water is for cleansing of sin and cleansing of impurity. So you got Numbers 19, Zechariah builds on this, and the New Testament builds even more on it to give us this beautiful picture of how the ashes of the red heifer preach the gospel of the Lamb of God, who finally takes away the sin of the world and takes away our death as well.
Yeah, and it turns out that Christ's death is the end of death, not only obviously for us who are brought into it, but it's the doing away with the animal sacrifice as well. No more red heifers need die. No more sheep or goats or turtle doves. It's all done. So that would all be for naught. So it is the finished work, and we don't even need to do things that represent it anymore. All of that's done.
Amen.
Amen. That's it, guys. Hey, next week, join us next week, because next week will be the special Christmas episode. That's what we'll be doing next week. So we'll be joined by Eric, and we're gonna look at something. We won't give it away, but we're gonna get a little Christmassy on the podcast. It's always fun. So we'll be doing that next week. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then. Thanks.